As the Camerlengo pulled himself up, he could hear Robert Langdon yelling excitedly, running toward the craft. "Now you understand," the Camerlengo thought. "Now you have faith." The Camerlengo pulled himself up into the cockpit, adjusted a few familiar levers, and then turned back to his window for the canister. But the guard to whom he had given the canister stood empty-handed. "He took it!" the guard yelled. The Camerlengo felt his heart seize. "Who?" the guard pointed. "Him." Robert Langdon was surprised by how heavy the canister was. He ran to the other side of the chopper and jumped in the rear compartment, where he and Vittoria had sat only hours ago. He left the door open and buckled himself in. Then he yelled to the Camerlengo in the front seat, "Fly, father!" The Camerlengo craned back at Langdon, his face bloodless with dread. "What are you doing?" "You fly, I'll throw," Langdon barked. "There's no time. Just fly the blessed chopper." The Camerlengo seemed momentarily paralyzed, the media lights glaring through the cockpit, darkening the creases in his face. "I can do this alone," he whispered. "I am supposed to do this alone." Langdon wasn't listening. "Fly," he heard himself screaming. "Now, I'm here to help you." Langdon looked down at the canister and felt his breath catch in his throat when he saw the numbers. 3 minutes, father. 3. The number seemed to stun the Camerlengo back to sobriety. Without hesitation, he turned back to the controls. With a grinding roar, the helicopter lifted off. Through a swirl of dust, Langdon could see Vittoria running toward the chopper. Their eyes met, and then she dropped away like a sinking stone. Chapter 122. Inside the chopper, the whine of the engines and the gale from the open door assaulted Langdon's senses with a deafening chaos. He steadied himself against the magnified drag of gravity as the Camerlengo accelerated the craft straight up. The glow of St. Peter's Square shrank beneath him until it was an amorphous, glowing ellipse radiating in a sea of city lights. The antimatter canister felt like a dead weight in Langdon's hands. He held tighter, his palms slick now with sweat and blood. Inside the trap, the globule of antimatter hovered calmly, pulsing red in the glow of the LED countdown clock. 2 minutes, Langdon yelled, wondering where the Camerlengo intended to drop the canister. The city lights beneath them spread out in all directions. In the distance to the west, Langdon could see the twinkling delineation of the Mediterranean coast, a jagged border of luminescence beyond which spread an endless, dark expanse of nothingness. The sea looked farther now than Langdon had imagined. Moreover, the concentration of lights at the coast was a stark reminder that even far out at sea, an explosion might have devastating effects. Langdon hadn't even considered the effects of a 10-kiloton tidal wave hitting the coast. When Langdon turned and looked straight ahead through the cockpit window, he was more hopeful. Directly in front of them, the rolling shadows of the Roman foothills loomed in the night. The hills were spotted with lights, the villas of the very wealthy. But a mile or so north, the hills grew dark. There were no lights at all, just a huge pocket of blackness. Nothing. The quarries, Langdon thought. La Cava Romana. Staring intently at the barren pocket of land, Langdon sensed that it was plenty large enough. It seemed close, too, much closer than the ocean. Excitement surged through him. This was obviously where the Camerlengo planned to take the antimatter. The chopper was pointing directly toward it. The quarries. Oddly, however, as the engine strained louder and the chopper hurtled through the air, Langdon could see that the quarries were not getting any closer. Bewildered, he shot a glance out the side door to get his bearings. What he saw doused his excitement in a wave of panic. Directly beneath them, thousands of feet straight down, glowed the media lights in St. Peter's Square. We're still over the Vatican. Camerlengo! Langdon choked. Go forward! We're high enough! You got to start moving forward! We can't drop the canister back over Vatican City! The Camerlengo didn't reply. He appeared to be concentrating on flying the craft. We've got less than 2 minutes! Langdon shouted, holding up the canister. I can see them. La Cava Romana, a couple of miles north. We don't have to...
No, Camerlengo said. It's far too dangerous. I'm sorry.
As the chopper continued to claw heavenward, the Camerlengo turned and gave Langdon a mournful smile.
I wish you had not come, my friend. You have made the ultimate sacrifice.
Langdon looked in the Camerlengo's exhausted eyes and suddenly understood. His blood turned to ice.
But there must be somewhere we can go.
Up, the Camerlengo replied, his voice resigned. It's the only guarantee. Langdon could barely think. He had entirely misinterpreted the Camerlengo's plan. Look to the heavens. Heaven, Langdon now realized, was literally where he was headed. The Camerlengo had never intended to drop the antimatter. He was simply getting it as far away from Vatican City as humanly possible. This was a one-way trip. Chapter 123 In St. Peter's Square, Vittoria Vetra stared upward. The helicopter was a speck now, the media lights no longer reaching it. Even the pounding of the rotors had faded to a distant hum. It seemed, in that instant, that the entire world was focused upward, silenced in anticipation, necks craned to the heavens. All peoples, all faiths, all hearts beating as one. Vittoria's emotions were a cyclone of twisting agonies. As the helicopter disappeared from sight, she pictured Robert's face rising above her. What had he been thinking? Didn't he understand? Around the square, television cameras probed the darkness, waiting. A sea of faces stared heavenward, united in a silent countdown. The media screens all flickered the same tranquil scene. A Roman sky illuminated with brilliant stars. Vittoria felt the tears begin to well. Behind her on the marble escarpment, 161 cardinals stared up in silent awe. Some folded their hands in prayer. Most stood motionless, transfixed. Some wept. The seconds ticked past. In homes, bars, businesses, airports, hospitals around the world, souls were joined in universal witness. Men and women locked hands. Others held their children. Time seemed to hover in limbo, souls suspended in unison. Then, cruelly, the bells of St. Peter's began to toll. Vittoria let the tears come. Then, with the whole world watching, time ran out. The dead silence of the event was the most terrifying of all. High above Vatican City, a pinpoint of light appeared in the sky. For a fleeting instant, a new heavenly body had been born, a speck of light as pure and white as anyone had ever seen. Then it happened. A flash. The point billowed, as if feeding on itself, unraveling across the sky in a dilating radius of blinding white. It shot out in all directions, accelerating with incomprehensible speed, gobbling up the dark. As the sphere of light grew, it intensified, like a burgeoning fiend preparing to consume the entire sky. It raced downward, toward them, picking up speed. Blinded, the multitudes of starkly lit human faces gasped as one, shielding their eyes, crying out in strangled fear. As the light roared out in all directions, the unimaginable occurred. As if bound by God's own will, the surging radius seemed to hit a wall. It was as if the explosion were contained somehow in a giant glass sphere. The light rebounded inward, sharpening, rippling across itself. The wave appeared to have reached a predetermined diameter and hovered there. For an instant, a perfect and silent sphere of light glowed over Rome. Night had become day. Then it hit. The concussion was deep and hollow, a thunderous shockwave from above. It descended on them like the wrath of hell, shaking the granite foundation of Vatican City, knocking the breath out of people's lungs, sending others stumbling backward. The reverberation circled the colonnade, followed by a sudden torrent of warm air. The wind tore through the square, letting out a sepulchral moan as it whistled through the columns and buffeted the walls. Dust swirled overhead as people huddled, witnesses to Armageddon. Then, as fast as it appeared, the sphere imploded, sucking back in on itself, crushing inward to the tiny point of light from which it had come. Chapter 124. Never before had so many been so silent. The faces in St. Peter's Square, one by one, averted their eyes from the darkening sky and turned downward, each person in his or her own private moment of wonder. The media lights followed suit, dropping their beams back to earth as if out of reverence for the blackness now settling upon them. It seemed for a moment the entire world was bowing its head in unison. Cardinal Mortati knelt to pray, and the other cardinals joined him. The Swiss guard lowered their long swords and stood numb. No one spoke. No one moved. Everywhere hearts shuddered with spontaneous emotion. Bereavement, fear, wonder, belief, and a dread-filled respect for the new and awesome power they had just witnessed. Vittoria Vetra stood trembling at the foot of the basilica's sweeping stairs. She closed her eyes. Through the tempest of emotions now coursing through her blood, a single word tolled like a distant bell. Pristine, cruel. She forced it away, and yet the word echoed. Again she drove it back. The pain was too great. She tried to lose herself in the images that blazed in others' minds. Antimatter's mind-boggling power. The Vatican's deliverance. The Camerlengo. Feats of bravery. Miracles. Selflessness. And still the word echoed, tolling through the chaos with a stinging loneliness. Robert. He had come for her at Castel Sant'Angelo. He had saved her. And now he had been destroyed by her creation. As Cardinal Mortati prayed, he wondered if he too would hear God's voice as the Camerlengo had. Does one need to believe in miracles to experience them? Mortati was a modern man in an ancient faith. Miracles had never played a part in his belief. Certainly his faith spoke of miracles, bleeding palms, ascensions from the dead, imprints on shrouds, and yet Mortati's rational mind had always justified these accounts as part of the myth. They were simply the result of man's greatest weakness, his need for proof. Miracles were nothing but stories we all clung to because we wished they were true. And yet, am I so modern that I cannot accept what my eyes have just witnessed? It was a miracle, was it not? Yes. God, with a few whispered words in the Camerlengo's ear, had intervened and saved his church. Why was this so hard to believe? What would it say about God if God had done nothing? That the Almighty did not care? That he was powerless to stop it? A miracle was the only possible response. As Mortati knelt in wonder, he prayed for the Camerlengo's soul. He gave thanks to the young chamberlain who, even in his youthful years, had opened this old man's eyes to the miracles of unquestioning faith. Incredibly, though, Mortati never suspected the extent to which his faith was about to be tested. The silence of St. Peter's Square broke with a ripple at first. The ripple grew to a murmur, and then suddenly to a roar. Without warning, the multitudes were crying out as one. Look! Look! Mortati opened his eyes and turned to the crowd. Everyone was pointing behind him, toward the front of St. Peter's Basilica. Their faces were white. Some fell to their knees. Some fainted. Some burst into uncontrollable sobs. Look! Look! Mortati turned, bewildered, following their outstretched hands. They were pointing to the uppermost level of the basilica, the rooftop terrace, where huge statues of Christ and his apostles watched over the crowd. There, on the right of Jesus, arms outstretched to the world,
stood Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca.
Chapter 125. Robert Langdon was no longer falling. There was no more terror, no pain, not even the sound of the racing wind. There was only the soft sound of lapping water, as though he were comfortably asleep on a beach. In a paradox of self-awareness, Langdon sensed this was death. He felt glad for it. He allowed the drifting numbness to possess him entirely. He let it carry him wherever it was he would go. His pain and fear had been anesthetized, and he didn't wish it back at any price. His final memory had been one that could only have been conjured in hell. "Take me, please." But the lapping that lulled in him a far-off sense of peace was also pulling him back. It was trying to awaken him from a dream. "No, let me be." He didn't want to awaken. He sensed demons gathering on the perimeter of his bliss, pounding to shatter his rapture. Fuzzy images swirled, voices yelled, wind churned. "No, please." The more he fought, the more the fury filtered through. Then, harshly, he was living it all again. The helicopter was in a dizzying, dead climb. He was trapped inside. Beyond the open door, the lights of Rome looked farther away with every passing second. His survival instinct told him to jettison the canister right now. Langdon knew it would take less than 20 seconds for the canister to fall half a mile, but it would be falling toward a city of people. Higher, higher. Langdon wondered how high they were now. Small prop planes, he knew, flew at altitudes of about 4 miles. This helicopter had to be a good fraction of that by now. 2 miles up? 3? There was still a chance. If they timed the drop perfectly, the canister would fall only partway toward Earth, exploding a safe distance over the ground and away from the chopper. Langdon looked out at the cities sprawling below them. "And if you calculate incorrectly?" the Camerlengo said. Langdon turned, startled. The Camerlengo wasn't even looking at him, apparently having read Langdon's thoughts from the ghostly reflection in the windshield. Oddly, the Camerlengo was no longer engrossed in the controls. His hands weren't even on the throttle. The chopper, it seemed, was now in some sort of autopilot mode, locked in a climb. The Camerlengo reached above his head to the ceiling of the cockpit, fishing behind a cable housing, where he removed a key, taped there out of view. Langdon watched in bewilderment as the Camerlengo quickly unlocked the metal cargo box bolted between the seats. He removed some sort of large black nylon pack. He laid it on the seat next to him. Langdon's thoughts churned. The Camerlengo's movements seemed composed, as if he had a solution. "Give me the canister," the Camerlengo said, his tone serene. Langdon didn't know what to think anymore. He thrust the canister to the Camerlengo. 90 seconds! What the Camerlengo did with the antimatter took Langdon totally by surprise. Holding the canister carefully in his hands, the Camerlengo placed it inside the cargo box. Then he closed the heavy lid and used the key to lock it tight.
"What are you doing?" Langdon demanded.
"Leading us from temptation." The Camerlengo threw the key out the open window. As the key tumbled into the night, Langdon felt his soul falling with it. The Camerlengo then took the nylon pack and slipped his arms through the straps. He fastened a waist clamp around his stomach and cinched it all down like a backpack. He turned to a dumbstruck Robert Langdon.
"I'm sorry," the Camerlengo said. "It wasn't supposed to happen this way."
Then he opened his door and hurled himself into the night. The image burned in Langdon's unconscious mind, and with it came the pain. Real pain, physical pain, aching, searing. He begged to be taken, to let it end. But as the water lapped louder in his ears, new images began to flash. His hell had only just begun. He saw bits and pieces, scattered frames of sheer panic. He lay halfway between death and nightmare, begging for deliverance, but the pictures grew brighter in his mind. The antimatter canister was locked out of reach. It counted relentlessly downward as the chopper shot upward. 50 seconds. Higher, higher. Langdon spun wildly in the cabin, trying to make sense of what he had just seen. 45 seconds. He dug under seats, searching for another parachute. 40 seconds. There was none. There had to be an option. 35 seconds. He raced to the open doorway of the chopper and stood in the raging wind, gazing down at the lights of Rome below. 32 seconds. And then he made the choice. The unbelievable choice. With no parachute, Robert Langdon had jumped out the door. As the night swallowed his tumbling body, the helicopter seemed to rocket off above him, the sound of his rotors evaporating in the deafening rush of his own freefall. As he plummeted toward Earth, Robert Langdon felt something he had not experienced since his years on the high dive, the inexorable pull of gravity during a dead drop. The faster he fell, the harder the Earth seemed to pull, sucking him down. This time, however, the drop was not 50 feet into a pool. The drop was thousands of feet into a city, an endless expanse of pavement and concrete. Somewhere in the torrent of wind and desperation, Kohler's voice echoed from the grave, words he had spoken earlier this morning standing in CERN's freefall tube. 1 square yard of drag will slow a falling body almost 20%. 20%, Langdon now realized, was not even close to what one would need to survive a fall like this. Nonetheless, more out of paralysis than hope, he clenched in his hands the sole object he had grabbed from the chopper on his way out the door. It was an odd memento, but it was one that for a fleeting instant had given him hope. The windshield tarp had been lying in the back of the helicopter. It was a concave rectangle, about 4 yards by 2, like a huge fitted sheet, the crudest approximation of a parachute imaginable. It had no harness, only bungee loops at either end, for fastening it to the curvature of the windshield. Langdon had grabbed it, slid his hands through the loops, held on, and leapt out into the void. His last great act of youthful defiance. No illusions of life beyond this moment. Langdon fell like a rock, feet first, arms raised, his hands gripping the loops. The tarp billowed like a mushroom overhead. The wind tore past him violently. As he plummeted toward Earth, there was a deep explosion somewhere above him. It seemed farther off than he had expected. Almost instantly, the shockwave hit. He felt the breath crushed from his lungs. There was a sudden warmth in the air all around him. He fought to hold on. A wall of heat raced down from above. The top of the tarp began to smolder, but held. Langdon rocketed downward, on the edge of a billowing shroud of light, feeling like a surfer trying to outrun a 1,000-foot tidal wave. Then, suddenly, the heat receded. He was falling again through the dark coolness. For an instant, Langdon felt hope. A moment later, though, that hope faded like the withdrawing heat above. Despite his straining arms assuring him that the tarp was slowing his fall, the wind still tore past his body with deafening velocity. Langdon had no doubt he was still moving too fast to survive the fall. He would be crushed when he hit the ground. Mathematical figures tumbled through his brain, but he was too numb to make sense of them. 1 square yard of drag, 20% reduction of speed. All Langdon could figure was that the tarp over his head was big enough to slow him more than 20%. Unfortunately, though, he could tell from the wind whipping past him that whatever good the tarp was doing was not enough. He was still falling fast. There would be no surviving the impact on the waiting sea of concrete. Beneath him, the lights of Rome spread out in all directions. The city looked like an enormous starlit sky that Langdon was falling into. The perfect expanse of stars was marred only by a dark strip that split the city in two, a wide, unlit ribbon that wound through the dots of light like a fat snake. Langdon stared down at the meandering swatch of black. Suddenly, like the surging crest of an unexpected wave, hope filled him again. With almost maniacal vigor, Langdon yanked down hard with his right hand on the canopy. The tarp suddenly flapped louder, billowing, cutting right to find the path of least resistance. Langdon felt himself drifting sideways. He pulled again, harder, ignoring the pain in his palm. The tarp flared, and Langdon sensed his body sliding laterally. Not much, but some. He looked beneath him again to the sinuous serpent of black. It was off to the right, but he was still pretty high. Had he waited too long? He pulled with all his might and accepted somehow that it was now in the hands of God. He focused hard on the whitest part of the serpent and, for the first time in his life, prayed for a miracle. The rest was a blur. The darkness rushing up beneath him, the diving instincts coming back, the reflexive locking of his spine and pointing of the toes, the inflating of his lungs to protect his vital organs, the flexing of his legs into a battering ram, and finally, the thankfulness that the winding Tiber River was raging, making its waters frothy and air-filled, and three times softer than standing water. Then there was impact and blackness. It had been the thundering sound of the flapping canopy that drew the group's eyes away from the fireball in the sky. The sky above Rome had been filled with sights tonight, a skyrocketing helicopter, an enormous explosion, and now this strange object that had plummeted into the churning waters of the Tiber River, directly off the shore of the river's tiny island, Isola Tiberina. Ever since the island had been used to quarantine the sick during the Roman plague of A.D. 1656, it had been thought to have mystic healing properties. For this reason, the island had later become the site for Rome's Hospital Tiberina. The body was battered when they pulled it onto shore. The man still had a faint pulse, which was amazing, they thought. They wondered if it was Isola Tiberina's mythical reputation for healing that had somehow kept his heart pumping. Minutes later, when the man began coughing and slowly regained consciousness, the group decided the island must indeed be magical. Chapter 126. Cardinal Mortati knew there were no words in any language that could have added to the mystery of this moment. The silence of the vision over St. Peter's Square sang louder than any chorus of angels. As he stared up at Camerlengo Ventresca, Mortati felt the paralyzing collision of his heart and mind. The vision seemed real, tangible, and yet, how could it be? Everyone had seen the Camerlengo get in the helicopter. They had all witnessed the ball of light in the sky. And now, somehow, the Camerlengo stood high above them on the rooftop terrace. Transported by angels? Reincarnated by the hand of God? This is impossible. Mortati's heart wanted nothing more than to believe, but his mind cried out for reason. And yet all around him, the cardinals stared up, obviously seeing what he was seeing, paralyzed with wonder. It was the Camerlengo, there was no doubt, but he looked different somehow. Divine, as if he had been purified. A spirit, a man. His white flesh shone in the spotlights with an incorporeal weightlessness. In the square there was crying, cheering, spontaneous applause. A group of nuns fell to their knees and wailed Saetas. A pulsing grew from in the crowd. Suddenly the entire square was chanting the Camerlengo's name. The cardinals, some with tears rolling down their faces, joined in. Mortati looked around him and tried to comprehend. Is this really happening? Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca stood on the rooftop terrace of St. Peter's Basilica and looked down over the multitudes of people staring up at him. Was he awake or dreaming? He felt transformed, otherworldly. He wondered if it was his body or just his spirit that had floated down from heaven toward the soft, darkened expanse of the Vatican City gardens, alighting like a silent angel on the deserted lawns, his black parachute shrouded from the madness by the towering shadow of St. Peter's Basilica. He wondered if it was his body or his spirit that had possessed the strength to climb the ancient stairway of medallions to the rooftop terrace where he now stood. He felt as light as a ghost. Although the people below were chanting his name, he knew it was not him they were cheering. They were cheering from impulsive joy, the same kind of joy he felt every day of his life as he pondered the Almighty. They were experiencing what each of them had always longed for, an assurance of the beyond, a substantiation of the power of the Creator. Camerlengo Ventresca had prayed all his life for this moment, and still even he couldn't fathom that God had found a way to make it manifest. He wanted to cry out to them, "Your God is a living God. Behold the miracles all around you." He stood there a while, numb, and yet feeling more than he had ever felt. When at last the spirit moved him, he bowed his head and stepped back from the edge. Alone now, he knelt on the roof and prayed. Chapter 127. The images around him blurred, drifting in and out. Langdon's eyes slowly began to focus. His legs ached and his body felt like it had been run over by a truck. He was lying on his side on the ground. Something stunk, like bile. He could still hear the incessant sound of lapping water. It no longer sounded peaceful to him. There were other sounds, too, talking close around him. He saw blurry white forms. Were they all wearing white? Langdon decided he was either in an asylum or heaven. From the burning in his throat, Langdon decided it could not be heaven. "He's finished vomiting," one man said in Italian. "Turn him." The voice was firm and professional. Langdon felt hands slowly rolling him onto his back. His head swam. He tried to sit up, but the hands gently forced him back down. His body submitted. Then Langdon felt someone going through his pockets, removing items. Then he passed out cold. Dr. Jacobus was not a religious man. The science of medicine had bred that from him long ago. And yet the events in Vatican City tonight had put his systematic logic to the test. Now bodies are falling from the sky? Dr. Jacobus felt the pulse of the bedraggled man they had just pulled from the Tiber River. The doctor decided that God himself had hand-delivered this one to safety. The concussion of hitting the water had knocked the victim unconscious, and if it had not been for Jacobus and his crew standing out on the shore, watching the spectacle in the sky, this falling soul would surely have gone unnoticed and drowned.
"Americano,"
a nurse said, going through the man's wallet after they pulled him to dry land. American. Romans often joked that Americans had gotten so abundant in Rome that hamburgers should become the official Italian food. But Americans falling from the sky? Jacobus flicked a penlight in the man's eyes, testing his dilation.
"Sir, can you hear me? Do you know where you are?"
The man was unconscious again. Jacobus wasn't surprised. The man had vomited a lot of water after Jacobus had performed CPR.
"Si chiama Robert Langdon,"
the nurse said, reading the man's driver's license. The group assembled on the dock all stopped short.
"Impossibile,"
Jacobus declared. Robert Langdon was the man from the television, the American professor who had been helping the Vatican. Jacobus had seen Mr. Langdon only minutes ago, getting into a helicopter in St. Peter's Square and flying miles up into the air. Jacobus and the others had run out to the dock to witness the antimatter explosion, a tremendous sphere of light like nothing any of them had ever seen. How could this be the same man?
"It's him," the nurse exclaimed, brushing his soaked hair back. "I recognize his tweed coat."
Suddenly someone was yelling from the hospital entryway. It was one of the patients. She was screaming, going mad, holding her portable radio to the sky and praising God. Apparently, Camerlengo Ventresca had just miraculously appeared on the roof of the Vatican. Dr. Jacobus decided, when his shift got off at 8 a.m., he was going straight to church. The lights over Langdon's head were brighter now, sterile. He was on some kind of examination table. He smelled astringents, strange chemicals. Someone had just given him an injection, and they had removed his clothes. Definitely not gypsies, he decided in his semi-conscious delirium. Aliens, perhaps. Yes, he had heard about things like this. Fortunately, these beings wouldn't harm him. All they wanted were his... Not on your life! Langdon sat bolt upright, eyes flying open. Attento! One of the creatures yelled, steadying him. His badge read, Dr. Jacobus. He looked remarkably human. Langdon stammered, I thought... Easy, Mr. Langdon. You're in a hospital. The fog began to lift. Langdon felt a wave of relief. He hated hospitals, but they certainly beat aliens harvesting his testicles. My name is Dr. Jacobus, the man said. He explained what had just happened. You are very lucky to be alive. Langdon didn't feel lucky. He could barely make sense of his own memories. The helicopter, the Camerlengo. His body ached everywhere. They gave him some water, and he rinsed out his mouth. They placed a new gauze on his palm. Where are my clothes? Langdon asked. He was wearing a paper robe. One of the nurses motioned to a dripping wad of shredded khaki and tweed on the counter. They were soaked. We had to cut them off you. Langdon looked at his shredded Harris tweed and frowned. You had some Kleenex in your pocket, the nurse said. It was then that Langdon saw the ravaged shreds of parchment clinging all over the lining of his jacket. The folio from Galileo's Diagramma. The last copy on Earth had just dissolved. He was too numb to know how to react. He just stared. We saved your personal items. She held up a plastic bin. Wallet, camcorder, and pen. I dried the camcorder off the best I could. I don't own a camcorder. The nurse frowned and held out the bin. Langdon looked at the contents. Along with his wallet and pen was a tiny Sony RUVI camcorder. He recalled it now. Kohler had handed it to him and asked him to give it to the media. We found it in your pocket. I think you'll need a new one, though. The nurse flipped open the 2-inch screen on the back. Your viewer is cracked. Then she brightened. The sound still works, though. Barely. She held the device up to her ear. Keeps playing something over and over. She listened a moment and then scowled, handing it to Langdon. Two guys arguing, I think. Puzzled, Langdon took the camcorder and held it to his ear. The voices were pinched and metallic, but they were discernible. One close, one far away. Langdon recognized them both. Sitting there in his paper gown, Langdon listened in amazement to the conversation. Although he couldn't see what was happening, when he heard the shocking finale, he was thankful he had been spared the visual. My God. As the conversation began playing again from the beginning, Langdon lowered the camcorder from his ear and sat in appalled mystification. The antimatter. The helicopter. Langdon's mind now kicked into gear. But that means... He wanted to vomit again. With a rising fury of disorientation and rage, Langdon got off the table and stood on shaky legs. Mr. Langdon... the doctor said, trying to stop him. I need some clothes, Langdon demanded, feeling the draft on his rear from the backless gown. But you need rest. I'm checking out now. I need some clothes. But, sir, you... Now! Everyone exchanged bewildered looks.
We have no clothes, the doctor said. Perhaps tomorrow a friend could bring you some.
Langdon drew a slow, patient breath and locked eyes with the doctor.
Dr. Jacobus, I'm walking out your door right now. I need clothes. I'm going to Vatican City. One does not go to Vatican City with one's ass hanging out. Do I make myself clear?
Dr. Jacobus swallowed hard.
Get this man something to wear.
When Langdon limped out of Hospital Tiberina, he felt like an overgrown Cub Scout. He was wearing a blue paramedic's jumpsuit that zipped up the front and was adorned with cloth badges that apparently depicted his numerous qualifications. The woman accompanying him was heavy-set and wore a similar suit. The doctor had assured Langdon she would get him to the Vatican in record time.
Molto traffico, Langdon said, reminding her that the area around the Vatican was packed with cars and people.
The woman looked unconcerned. She pointed proudly to one of her patches.
Sono conducente di ambulanza.
Ambulanza? That explained it. Langdon felt like he could use an ambulance ride. The woman led him around the side of the building. On an outcropping over the water was a cement deck where her vehicle sat waiting. When Langdon saw the vehicle, he stopped in his tracks. It was an aging medevac chopper. The hull read, Aero Ambulanza. He hung his head. The woman smiled.
Fly Vatican City. Very fast.
Chapter 128. The College of Cardinals bristled with ebullience and electricity as they streamed back into the Sistine Chapel. In contrast, Mortati felt in himself a rising confusion he thought might lift him off the floor and carry him away. He believed in the ancient miracles of the scriptures, and yet what he had just witnessed in person was something he could not possibly comprehend. After a lifetime of devotion, 79 years, Mortati knew these events should ignite in him a pious exuberance, a fervent and living faith. And yet all he felt was a growing, spectral unease. Something did not feel right.
Signore Mortati, a Swiss guard yelled, running down the hall. We have gone to the roof as you asked. The Camerlengo is flesh. He is a true man. He is not a spirit. He is exactly as we knew him.
Did he speak to you?
He kneels in silent prayer. We are afraid to touch him.
Mortati was at a loss.
Tell him his cardinals await.
Signore, because he is a man...
The guard hesitated.
What is it?
His chest. He is burned. Should we bind his wounds? He must be in pain.
Mortati considered it. Nothing in his lifetime of service to the church had prepared him for this situation.
He is a man... So serve him as a man. Bathe him, bind his wounds, dress him in fresh robes. We await his arrival in the Sistine Chapel.
The guard ran off. Mortati headed for the chapel. The rest of the cardinals were inside now. As he walked down the hall, he saw Vittoria Vetra slumped alone on a bench at the foot of the royal staircase. He could see the pain and loneliness of her loss, and wanted to go to her. But he knew it would have to wait. He had work to do, although he had no idea what that work could possibly be. Mortati entered the chapel. There was a riotous excitement. He closed the door.
God help me.
Hospital Tiberina's twin-rotor Aero Ambulanza circled in behind Vatican City, and Langdon clenched his teeth, swearing to God this was the very last helicopter ride of his life. After convincing the pilot that the rules governing Vatican airspace were the least of the Vatican's concerns right now, he guided her in, unseen, over the rear wall, and landed them on the Vatican's helipad.
Grazie, he said,
lowering himself painfully onto the ground. She blew him a kiss and quickly took off, disappearing back over the wall and into the night. Langdon exhaled, trying to clear his head, hoping to make sense of what he was about to do. With the camcorder in hand, he boarded the same golf cart he had ridden earlier that day. It hadn't been charged, and the battery meter registered close to empty. Langdon drove without headlights to conserve power. He also preferred no one see him coming. At the back of the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortati stood in a daze as he watched the pandemonium before him.
"It was a miracle!" one of the cardinals shouted. "The work of God!"
"Yes," others exclaimed. "God has made his will manifest."
"The Camerlengo will be our pope," another shouted. "He is not a cardinal, but God has sent a miraculous sign."
"Yes," someone agreed. "The laws of conclave are man's laws. God's will is before us. I call for a balloting immediately."
"A balloting?" Mortati demanded, moving toward them. "I believe that is my job." Everyone turned. Mortati could sense the cardinals studying him. They seemed distant, at a loss, offended by his sobriety. Mortati longed to feel his heart swept up in the miraculous exultation he saw on the faces around him, but he was not. He felt an inexplicable pain in his soul, an aching sadness he couldn't explain. He had vowed to guide these proceedings with purity of soul, and this hesitancy was something he could not deny.
"My friends," Mortati said, stepping to the altar. His voice didn't seem his own. "I suspect I will struggle for the rest of my days with the meaning of what I have witnessed tonight. And yet, what you are suggesting regarding the Camerlengo, it cannot possibly be God's will."
The room fell silent.
"How can you say that?"
one of the cardinals finally demanded.
"The Camerlengo saved the church. God spoke to the Camerlengo directly. The man survived death itself. What sign do we need?"
"The Camerlengo is coming to us now," Mortati said. "Let us wait. Let us hear him before we have a balloting. There may be an explanation."
"An explanation?"
"As your great elector, I have vowed to uphold the laws of conclave. You are no doubt aware that by holy law, the Camerlengo is ineligible for election to the papacy. He is not a cardinal. He is a priest, a chamberlain. There is also the question of his inadequate age."
Mortati felt the stares hardening.
"By even allowing a balloting, I would be requesting that you endorse a man who Vatican law proclaims ineligible. I would be asking each of you to break a sacred oath."
"But what happened here tonight?" someone stammered. "It certainly transcends our laws."
"Does it?"
Mortati boomed, not even knowing where his words were coming from.
"Is it God's will that we discard the rules of the church? Is it God's will that we abandon reason and give ourselves over to frenzy?"
"But did you not see what we saw?"
another challenged angrily.
"How can you presume to question that kind of power?"
Mortati's voice bellowed now with a resonance he had never known.
"I am not questioning God's power. It is God who gave us reason and circumspection. It is God we serve by exercising prudence."
Chapter 129. In the hallway outside the Sistine Chapel, Vittoria Vetra sat benumbed on a bench at the foot of the royal staircase. When she saw the figure coming through the rear door, she wondered if she was seeing another spirit. He was bandaged, limping, and wearing some kind of medical suit. She stood, unable to believe the vision.
"Robert?"
He never answered. He strode directly to her and wrapped her in his arms. When he pressed his lips to hers, it was an impulsive, longing kiss, filled with thankfulness. Vittoria felt the tears coming.
"Oh, God! Oh, thank God!"
He kissed her again, more passionately, and she pressed against him, losing herself in his embrace. Their bodies locked as if they had known each other for years. She forgot the fear and pain. She closed her eyes, weightless in the moment.
"It is God's will,"
someone was yelling, his voice echoing in the Sistine Chapel.
"Who but the Chosen One could have survived that diabolical explosion?"
"Me," a voice reverberated from the back of the channel. Mortati and the others turned in wonder at the bedraggled form coming up the center aisle.
"Mr. Langdon?"
Without a word, Langdon walked slowly to the front of the chapel. Vittoria Vetra entered too. Then two guards hurried in, pushing a cart with a large television on it. Langdon waited while they plugged it in, facing the cardinals. Then Langdon motioned for the guards to leave. They did, closing the door behind them. Now it was only Langdon, Vittoria, and the cardinals. Langdon plugged the Sony RUVI's output into the television. Then he pressed play. The television blared to life. The scene that materialized before the cardinals revealed the Pope's office. The video had been awkwardly filmed, as if by hidden camera. Off-center on the screen, the Camerlengo stood in the dimness in front of a fire. Although he appeared to be talking directly to the camera, it quickly became evident that he was speaking to someone else, whoever was making this video. Langdon told them the video was filmed by Maximilian Kohler, the director of CERN. Only an hour ago, Kohler had secretly recorded his meeting with the Camerlengo by using a tiny camcorder covertly mounted under the arm of his wheelchair. Mortati and the cardinals watched in bewilderment. Although the conversation was already in progress, Langdon didn't bother to rewind. Apparently, whatever Langdon wanted the cardinals to see was coming up.
"Leonardo Vetra kept diaries," the Camerlengo was saying. "I suppose that is good news for CERN, if the diaries contain his processes for creating antimatter."
"They don't," Kohler said. "You will be relieved to know those processes died with Leonardo. However, his diaries spoke of something else. You."
The Camerlengo looked troubled.
"I don't understand."
"They described a meeting Leonardo had last month with you."
The Camerlengo hesitated, then looked toward the door.
"Rocher should not have granted you access without consulting me. How did you get in here?"
"Rocher knows the truth. I called earlier and told him what you have done."
"What I have done?"
"Whatever story you told him, Rocher is a Swiss guard and far too faithful to this church to believe a bitter scientist over his Camerlengo." "Actually, he is too faithful not to believe. He is so faithful that despite the evidence that one of his loyal guards had betrayed the church, he refused to accept it. All day long he has been searching for another explanation."
"So you gave him one?"
"The truth, shocking as it was."
"If Rocher believed you, he would have arrested me."
"No, I wouldn't let him. I offered him my silence in exchange for this meeting."
The Camerlengo let out an odd laugh.
"You plan to blackmail the church with a story that no one will possibly believe?"
"I have no need of blackmail. I simply want to hear the truth from your lips. Leonardo Vetra was a friend."
The Camerlengo said nothing. He simply stared down at Kohler.
"Try this," Kohler snapped. "About a month ago, Leonardo Vetra contacted you requesting an urgent audience with the Pope. An audience you granted, because the Pope was an admirer of Leonardo's work, and because Leonardo said it was an emergency."
The Camerlengo turned to the fire. He said nothing.
"Leonardo came to the Vatican in great secrecy. He was betraying his daughter's confidence by coming here, a fact that troubled him deeply, but he felt he had no choice. His research had left him deeply conflicted, and in need of spiritual guidance from the church. In a private meeting, he told you and the Pope that he had made a scientific discovery with profound religious implications. He had proved Genesis was physically possible, and that intense sources of energy, what Vaitre called God, could duplicate the moment of creation. Silence. The Pope was stunned, Kohler continued. He wanted Leonardo to go public. His Holiness thought this discovery might begin to bridge the gap between science and religion, one of the Pope's life dreams. Then Leonardo explained to you the downside, the reason he required the Church's guidance. It seems his creation experiment, exactly as your Bible predicts, produced everything in pairs, opposites, light and dark. Vaitre found himself, in addition to creating matter, creating antimatter. Shall I go on? The Camerlengo was silent. He bent down and stoked the coals. After Leonardo Vaitre came here, Kohler said, you came to CERN to see his work. Leonardo's diary said you made a personal trip to his lab. The Camerlengo looked up. Kohler went on. The Pope could not travel without attracting media attention, so he sent you. Leonardo gave you a secret tour of his lab. He showed you an antimatter annihilation, the Big Bang, the power of creation. He also showed you a large specimen he kept locked away as proof that his new process could produce antimatter on a large scale. You were in awe. You returned to Vatican City to report to the Pope what you had witnessed. The Camerlengo sighed. And what is it that troubles you? That I would respect Leonardo's confidentiality by pretending before the world tonight that I knew nothing of antimatter? No. It troubles me that Leonardo Vaitre practically proved the existence of your God, and you had him murdered. The Camerlengo turned now, his face revealing nothing. The only sound was the crackle of the fire. Suddenly the camera jiggled, and Kohler's arm appeared in the frame. He leaned forward, seeming to struggle with something affixed beneath his wheelchair. When he sat back down, he held a pistol out before him. The camera angle was a chilling one, looking from behind down the length of the outstretched gun, directly at the Camerlengo. Kohler said, "Confess your sins, Father. Now." The Camerlengo looked startled. "You will never get out of here alive. Death would be a welcome relief from the misery your faith has put me through since I was a boy." Kohler held the gun with both hands now. "I am giving you a choice. Confess your sins, or die right now." The Camerlengo glanced toward the door. "Roger is outside," Kohler challenged. "He too is prepared to kill you."
"Roger is a sworn protector of the..."
"Roger let me in here, armed. He is sickened by your lies. You have a single option. Confess to me. I have to hear it from your very lips."
The Camerlengo hesitated. Kohler cocked his gun.
"Do you really doubt I will kill you?"
"No matter what I tell you," the Camerlengo said, "a man like you will never understand."
"Try me."
The Camerlengo stood still for a moment, a dominant silhouette in the dim light of the fire. When he spoke, his words echoed with a dignity more suited to the glorious recounting of altruism than that of a confession.
"Since the beginning of time," the Camerlengo said, "this church has fought the enemies of God, sometimes with words, sometimes with swords, and we have always survived."
The Camerlengo radiated conviction.
"But the demons of the past," he continued, "were demons of fire and abomination. They were enemies we could fight, enemies who inspired fear. Yet Satan is shrewd.
As time passed, he cast off his diabolical countenance for a new face, the face of pure reason. Transparent and insidious, but soulless all the same. The Camerlengo's voice flashed sudden anger, an almost maniacal transition.